on chapter 19. So 2 Samuel chapter 19, and we'll read together from verse 40, and we'll read into chapter 20. So first of all, 2 Samuel 19 and verse 40. The setting here was to do with David after the time with Absalom, the rebellion of Absalom. He's returning home to Jerusalem. In the chapter already, he's dealt with a number of different individuals. And we're picking up then in verse 40. So 2 Samuel 19, verse 40, let's hear the word of God. Then the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. And all the people of Judah conducted the king, and also half the people of Israel. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said unto the king, Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away, and have brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over Jordan? And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, Because the king is near of kin to us. Wherefore then be ye angry for this matter? Have we eaten at all of the king's cost, or hath he given us any gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, We have 10 parts in the king, and we have also more right in David than ye. Why then did ye despise us, that our advice should not be first had in bringing back the king, our king? And the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. And there happened to be there a man of Belial, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah clave unto their king, from Jordan even to Jerusalem. And David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in ward, and fed them, but went not in unto them. So they were shut up unto the day of their death, living in widowhood. Then said the king to Amasa, Assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and be thou here present. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he tarried longer than the set time which he had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, Now shall Sheba the son of Bichri do us more harm than did Absalom. Take thou thy lord's servants and pursue after him, lest he get him fenced cities and escape us. And there went out after him Joab's men, and the Kerethites, and the Pelethites, and all the mighty men. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue after Sheba the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone which is in Gibeon, Amasa went before them. And Joab's garment that he had put on was girded onto him, and upon it a girdle with a sword fastened upon his loins in the sheath thereof. And as he went forth, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, Art thou in health, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with the right hand to kiss him. But Amasa took no heed to the sword that was in Joab's hand. So he smote him therewith in the fifth rib, and shed out his bowels to the ground, and struck him not again, and he died. So Joab and Abishai his brother pursued after Sheba the son of Bichri. And one of Joab's men stood by him and said, He that favoureth Joab, and he that is for David, let him go after Joab. And Amasa wallowed in blood in the midst of the highway. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa out of the highway into the field, and cast a cloth upon him, when he saw that every one that came by him stood still. When he was removed out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue after Sheba, the son of Bichri. And we're going to end there at the end of verse 13. And trust the Lord to bless the reading of his word. Before the launch of Christ's public ministry, there was one key name attracting a whole lot of attention in Israel. One man who just drew the interest of the multitudes, and that was John the Baptist. So people flocked to him from all sorts of places to hear his preaching, and many were baptized of him. A good number started to follow him. But then the Lord's ministry began, and of course John pointed to him. Behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. But you read of an occasion in John chapter 3 when some of the Jews came to John the Baptist, and they were saying to him in verse 26, Rabbi, he that was with thee beyond Jordan, to whom thou bearest witness, behold, the same baptizeth, and all men come to him. So they were saying to John the Baptist, John, you bore witness to this person, but now look, he's baptizing, the people are coming to him, he's stepping into your position. He's gaining more fame and more popularity than you are. And John's answer on that occasion summed up the attitude that really should be found in all of our hearts. He reminded them that he'd never claimed to be the Christ. He was always pointing to someone greater than himself. And then he said in John 3 and verse 30, he must increase, but I must decrease. He must increase, but I must decrease. And his point was, it's not about me. It's not about me having the prominent position. It's not about me having the best of places, the glory, the honour. He, Christ, must increase. And it's my place to decrease, to fade into the background as men gaze upon his glory. I'm simply a servant of his. Now that's the attitude that should be found in any of us who name the name of Christ. A humility that says, let the Lord be glorified, let his will be done. I'm happy simply to be a servant in his cause. Well, as we come back to David and the narrative that we've read together, it emphasises how important the attitude of John the Baptist is. Because here, in numerous ways, you have the exact opposite. Instead of humility, there's pride. Instead of joyful satisfaction in serving, there are numerous individuals and groups stretching forth to have the preeminent position. So again, here's David, and it's a key moment in his life because after the time of exile during the rebellion of Absalom, he's now able to return home to Jerusalem. We're given a few of the details of people he dealt with, Shimei, Mephibosheth, Barzillai. But now we're dealing with the practicalities of David actually being brought across the River Jordan and being brought back to Jerusalem. It should be a fairly straightforward process. He's crossing the River Jordan, he's on his way home, the problems should be resolved. Absalom, the traitor, is dead. His rebellion has now come to nothing. Everything should be straightforward here. It's just David coming home. But it's not straightforward. Troubles come. And the troubles that flow in this portion, they come about because of the exact opposite attitude than the one held by John the Baptist. It comes about through pride, through a people who are striving for preeminence. They want the chief position. They want the glory. They want the honour for themselves. And so I want to look at this portion that we've read together under the title, The Destructive Desire for Preeminence. The Destructive Desire for Preeminence. This pride pushing for the glory and the honour for yourself. Now, first of all, as you think of that kind of attitude, I want you to notice this row that it produced. The row that it produced. Proverbs 13 verse 10 tells us, only by pride cometh contention, but with the well-advised is wisdom. Pride often results in contention, and that's certainly what happened here. Now, it all starts because when David crossed the River Jordan to go to Gilgal, as verse 40 tells us, all the people of Judah conducted the king, but only half the people of Israel. Now, when it divides them up, Judah and Israel, it's using the sort of the language that will become prominent later when there's a proper divide between, Judah in the south and the kingdom of Israel in the north. But Israel there is really referring to the northern tribes at this point. Now, if you remember a number of weeks back after Absalom had been dealt with, it was the people of Israel, it was the northern tribes who were actually the quickest to talk about bringing David home from exile. And Judah had been slow, and David had to write to them, send them word saying, you know, why are you so slow to talk about bringing me back? Why are you, my tribe, not acting first to bring me back home? Now clearly Judah had responded to that call, and so when the time comes, Judah were there, they were well represented, they'd met with David, they're there, all of them, to welcome David back across the River Jordan. But while all of Judah was represented, only half of the people of Israel were represented. Now, it's probably not the case, by the way, that the, you know, man for man, the whole nation was right there at Gilgal, but probably the idea is that Judah had representatives for all of their different families and groups, whereas Israel was only partly represented at the river. Now, even there, you know, you might be thinking to yourself, well, so what? What's the big deal? And I suppose that is the right question. You know, what is the big deal? The important thing is that David is being returned to Jerusalem. You know, this is what everyone wants. But for Israel, this was not just a little trivial matter that all of Judah were represented, but only half of them. They lay the challenge to David in verse 41. Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away, and have brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over Jordan? So they accuse Judah of stealing David away. They're saying, Judah has stolen our opportunity to be involved in this. Judah have taken from us the opportunity to have a place in the grand procession home. And the basic problem is one of pride, that Judah should be fully represented as the king is restored, and they are, at least to appearances, left out or shunned to some extent. They weren't happy that Judah would have the glory for bringing the king back. They needed a share in that glory. Now, just stop and think about it. You know, the sensible thing would simply be to rejoice that the king was returning. And at the end of the day, that's what everyone wanted. Israel had been the first to say, yes, it's time to bring David home. Judah were slower, but they'd agreed too. It's time to bring David home. This is what everyone wanted. And the important thing was that the God-anointed king was placed back where he belonged, back on the throne of the nation. You know, that God's blessing might be known again through times of, you know, peace and even favour under the rule of David. That's the important thing. The king is returning. But Israel can't focus on what's important. Instead, they're so taken up with this fact that Judah gets the glory for bringing David home, and they were partly left out. It's certainly not the attitude of, he must increase, we must decrease. Instead, it is, we must increase with him. And you'll notice that through their hurt pride, they put the worst possible construction upon what Judah had done. Instead of giving Judah the benefit of the doubt and, you know, rejoicing and saying, well, those men of Judah, they were just, they loved the king, and they just wanted to bring him home as fast as possible. They didn't want to waste time. You know, we're glad to have zealous men like those as part of our nation. Instead of that, they accused Judah of stealing the king away. Judah have done this maliciously. Judah have acted here to spite us. That they've done this to steal the glory from us, to keep the glory for themselves, that they're going to be known now as the ones who brought David home, and we get left out. Now, from what we're told in the text, Judah seemed to have had a perfectly good defence of their actions. They say in verse 42 that they moved quickly to bring the king home because, after all, he is near of kin to them. David was from their tribe. It was appropriate that they shouldn't keep him waiting. It was appropriate they should take steps to bring him home quickly. In fact, he'd even told them that. You know, why are you so slow? And he urged them to take action to that end. They then have good questions. That is, Judah has good questions. Wherefore then be ye angry for this matter? Have we eaten at all of the king's cost, or hath he given us any gift? And what's implied there is that they haven't. Now, they haven't eaten at the king's cost, they haven't received a gift. They're saying, we've not done this to benefit ourselves. We haven't received any special favour from David for doing this. He hasn't, you know, given us the honour of the most loyal subjects and rewarded us for it. We haven't been trying to get political advantage over you. We simply brought our kinsman home. Now, maybe there was further motivation in Judah's hearts. We don't know. We're not told. But in terms of what we've got before us, they do have a perfectly good reason for acting. And yet, the northern tribes, who were only half represented, they can't help but be suspicious. Judah has done this maliciously. Judah wanted to steal the glory for themselves. They've stolen the king away from us. They get the credit for bringing the king home. In one of the commentaries I was reading, Gordon, I'm not sure if it's Keady or Keddy, he makes the good observation in his commentary. He says, the truth is that Israel was only attributing to Judah what it had wanted to do itself. Get the glory for bringing back the king. And he makes the point, it is easier to attribute our own sins to others than to suspect them of the innocence that we do not ourselves possess. So that's what is going on here in Israelite hearts. They're so obsessed with the glory of getting the king back that they just assume Judah must be thinking like that too. Judah want the glory for getting the king back. They can't even imagine that Judah would act in innocence. Well, Israel came back at Judah's defence. They said in verse 43, we have 10 parts in the king, and we have also more right in David than ye. Why then did ye despise us, that our advice should not be first had in bringing back our king? That they're basically saying, Judah, you're one tribe. We're 10. We make up more of the nation than you. So surely you should have been getting our counsel before you brought the king back. Surely you needed our agreement before bringing the king back to rule over us. Now, it's not as if Judah has done anything against the will of Israel. Again, earlier in the chapter, Israel had already agreed it was time for David to come home. So it's not as if Judah have done something that Israel didn't want. They wanted David back. But they're saying, you should have sought our agreement. Now, it's worth adding, you know, Judah don't need Israel's agreement. Neither does Israel need Judah's agreement. In fact, the only thing that was important was that David is the God-anointed king. Doesn't matter if everyone else likes him or doesn't like him. God has set him on the throne. Israel didn't set him on the throne. The men of Judah didn't set him on the throne. God set him on the throne. So what does it matter whether the tribes of Israel say yes or no or what they say? The matter was irrelevant. God put David on the throne. The throne was David's by divine right. But Israel are accusing Judah. You should have got our say-so. The men of Judah aren't without fault either, by the way, because at the end of the chapter, you're told that they rose to the quarrel. They might have acted innocently at first, but in fact, in the end, their words became fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. Instead of giving the soft answer that turns away wrath, Judah's pride got the better of them too, and they weren't willing to remain humble. They got stuck into the thing as well, and so the whole matter just escalates. The thing breaks out into a full-blown row. And again, let me stress, you think how foolish this row is. The problem is not really with what just happened. Everyone was in agreement. David ought to be brought home. If Israel had decided that before Judah. The problem here instead is one of injured feelings and fears of being disadvantaged. It all flows from the pride of heart, which says, we need to protect our interests. I need to have the ascendancy. I need the chief place. Israel are annoyed not because they didn't get their way. They did get their way. David's coming home. They're annoyed because their advice wasn't sought. They weren't treated as the honourable people that they thought themselves to be. It was a problem of feeling personally put down in some way. Now, this was a time when, following the days of division during Absalom's rebellion, the tribes of Israel really ought to be coming together in a common cause, cooperating in the service of David, working for the advancement of the kingdom. And yet here's pride and this destructive desire for preeminence, and it gets in the way of it all. It causes division between brethren. And as you read this account at the end of chapter 19, we really should recognize that this problem has not gone away at all. Because the pride that you see in Israel and Judah here is still very obviously with us. And you see that over and over again when churches are ripped in half, often over the most foolish of quibbles. And the quibble might be dressed up sometimes as being, you know, a major difference on key issues, but so often it comes down to base pride. So often, the really divisive things, it just comes down to pride. Now, yes, there's some times where churches have to, I suppose, hold differences. So there's times where we have differences in doctrine and in certain areas. But you find it across the board. So often, those big, especially those bitter divisions in a congregation, it comes down to pride. Again, you think of what we're told in Proverbs. Only by pride cometh contention. You see some fighting, what's the source of it? You can be sure what it is. It's pride. Where there's bitter fighting, pride is at the root of it. And we're prone to it, just like Israel, just like many others who've gone before us and who are still around today. We're prone to it. We're very much like the disciples of Christ, who in Mark 9, they were quarrelling among themselves, and they were embarrassed a little bit when the Lord asked them the question in Mark 9:33. What was it that you disputed among yourselves, by the way? Christ had observed these disciples have been quarrelling, and he asks them, he knew fine right, but he asks them to expose the thing. What were you quarrelling about? What was the problem? And they're embarrassed. They held their peace, for by the way, they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. There they are in the service of Christ, walking with him in a fairly humble way outwardly. You know, their circumstances are humble. They don't have fancy mansions and flash cars. They're in very humble circumstances. The Son of Man that they're following has nowhere to lay his head. But inwardly, pride is there in a big way. And here they are. They're quarrelling over who's the greatest among us. You know, it's far too easy for us to feel slighted sometimes over the most foolish things, and suddenly, instead of cooperating with one another in the cause of Christ, we're so taken up with ourselves and our personal glory, and that person really attacked me and my status and so on. We're taken up with our glory, our personal ambitions, and then there's division with those who we, sometimes even just who we think, have harmed us in some way. Of course, again, it's the exact opposite attitude we're to take. We're to take the attitude of John the Baptist. He must increase. I must decrease. As Christ addressed that spirit of pride in his disciples, he sat them down and called the 12 and said unto them, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all and servant of all. There's what we're striving for. Not to have the chief seats, the upper rooms, the best of places. The Pharisees and scribes were after that. We're to be striving to serve, to humbly serve one another. Again saying, he, Christ, must increase. It's my place to decrease. So we've thought about this row that was produced. Then notice that this destructive desire for preeminence, it brought about rebellion. The rebellion that it produced. As we move into chapter 20, we continue to see this destruction through pride and especially the idea of rebellion. And I put it to you that there are actually two types of rebellions in this chapter. We have what I'll call the external or the obvious rebellion. And then we have the internal rebellion. And I'll explain what I mean by those terms in a minute. First of all, let's think about what I'm calling the external rebellion. The dispute between Judah and Israel didn't stop at a few foolish words. It escalated very quickly into outright rebellion. And it was instigated by a man called Sheba. He's there in the midst of the crowd that day. He's described in verse 1 of chapter 20 as a man of Belial. That is, he's a lawless man. He's an immoral man, a worthless person, morally. And so using the perceived offence of Judah against Israel as his motive, he blows the trumpet, a rallying cry to his tribes, and he urges them that they have no part with David. He's pretty much saying, you see what the tribe of Judah have done? They've stolen David away for themselves. They've left us really no claim upon David whatsoever, so it's time to abandon him. And verse 2 says that the men of Israel went up from David and followed this man Sheba, whereas the men of Judah stood by David. Now, once again, you find David in a very dangerous position. You know, there he is, And he's come back from one disaster with the rebellion of Absalom, and it should have been going very smoothly. But now it seems like there could be this full-scale revolt of the northern tribes against him. It feels like it could very easily go back to the days before he was king over everything, and when he was just the king of Judah, and he was, you know, there was this sort of tense time against the northern kingdom under Ishbosheth. It looks like the nation could be divided in two. Sheva was a man from the tribe of Benjamin. He probably was of a similar mindset to Shimei, who'd earlier cursed David. He probably still holds a grudge against David ever since the demise of Saul, who was also a Benjamite. But all of that's in the background. But certainly at this moment, he has been ready, like the rest of Israel, to bring David back, to restore David. And yet there's a total turnaround, because now he uses the division to launch revolt, rebellion against the king. And he calls Israel openly away from David. Follow me, don't follow David. Here's someone who, if he's feeling slighted by Judah, if he feels like he can't have a chief place with David, he's going to have no part with David. If he can't have the chief places, one of them at least, he's not going to participate in the whole system. If he can't be first, he certainly won't be last. He's going to have nothing to do with it. And so pride in his heart leads him to outright and open rebellion against the God-given king. He does the very thing that Satan did when Satan rebelled against God out of pride. He does the very same thing as you have the man of sin described in 2 Thessalonians, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God. One who sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God, and pride, wanting to lift himself up. So as you think about this open rebellion of Sheba, we really ought to take on board how dangerous a thing pride is in our hearts. You know, we have a tendency to make excuses for our pride. You know, for the most part, it's not as if we're actually doing anything that looks very obvious. It's not as if we've physically stolen something. It's not as if we've given ourselves over to a life of drunkenness. It's not as if we're engaged in sexual immorality or something like that. And so we think that because there's no obvious or tangible, clear deed, that pride surely isn't anywhere near as serious as those things. It's something we don't have to worry about too much. And yet that's not the case. Pride is a killer. It's deadly. It's interesting, in Ezekiel 16 and verse 49, that in condemning Israel, the Lord compares them to Sodom and challenges them, saying that Sodom has, you know, not gone as far in sinfulness as Israel did. And then highlights the sin of Sodom. It says, "Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me." Now, when we think of the sins of Sodom, we tend to think of the, you know, physical act of indecency, the clear and obvious immorality that was going on there, and that's certainly all part of it. When the Lord says, they committed abominations before me. But, you know, in that verse in Ezekiel, you find that at the heart of it, even behind the physical acting out of dreadful sin against God, behind it was pride and haughtiness, among other things. The serious issue behind the scenes, under the surface, was pride. Now, that's not to take away from the dreadfulness of the acted out deeds. Not at all. Those things were dreadful. They were an abomination before God. But don't neglect the fact that pride, this thing that sometimes we can make excuses for as if it's not too serious, that was behind it. You know, we need to recognize that pride is not something we can excuse in our lives, because it can lead to open and outright rebellion against the Lord. It can lead into extreme sin in defiance of our God. And in fact, perhaps you could say that the best way to fight, you know, the physical manifestation of your sin in your life, the best way to fight the obvious outward sins in your life, it is to first fight this inward sin of pride and to have your heart humbled before the Lord. Pride is what led Sheba into open rebellion and departure from the God-given king. And pride will lead us into many sins if we don't allow the gospel to address that issue, the pride that can raise its head so quickly within our hearts. Now that's the external rebellion, the obvious, the open rebellion. But it's not the only one in this chapter. We're also told about what I'm calling an internal rebellion. And by that I'm referring to an individual who remained within the camp of David. He remained outwardly as a loyal servant of David. And yet you see a similar state of rebellion within his heart and even rebellion against David. I'm talking about Joab here. As you go on in the chapter, despite what Sheba had done, David returns to Jerusalem. We're told briefly about how he dealt with his concubines. He put them in ward. These were the woman that he'd left in Jerusalem and who had been abused by Absalom. There's a sad reminder, I suppose, just in that verse of just how devastating the consequences of sin can be. And you think of these women, they're going to be cared for now, but they're just shut up until the day of their death, living in widowhood. But David deals with that matter. He certainly cares for them, but they have to be put away. And then the preparations are made for dealing with Sheba and the men of Israel who followed him. In verse 4, David commands Amasa, his new general, to go and assemble the men of Judah, present himself within 3 days, ready to pursue Sheba. David was going to act quickly, stamping out this problem. So just to remind you of the name, in case you're not sure, Amasa was the man who had been Absalom's general. He was, you know, the commander of the forces that came against David previously. But you might remember that following that battle, when Absalom was killed by Joab, and David had stripped Joab of his role as chief commander of his army, and David had surprisingly given that role to Amasa, with whom he reconciled. So Amasa, this man, now has Joab's old job. And you can guess that it probably didn't go down very well with Joab. He lost his position as David's right-hand man. He'd lost the preeminent position right beside David. And he's not content with that. He's going to do something about it. We're told exactly what he did. First of all, in verse 5, Amasa went off at David's command to assemble the men of Judah. For whatever reason, he took longer than the time David had given him. We don't know what the issue was. Some suggest he just struggled to get David's men to follow him. After all, he had been an enemy not so long ago. I don't know if that's the reason or not. We're certainly not told that it was anything malicious, but either way, he took too long to get back, and so David calls not for Joab, but for Abishai. He bypasses Joab again. He calls Abishai, who was Joab's brother, and tells him, take the men, pursue, and pursue Sheba before it's too late. So in verse 7, Abishai goes out, so does Joab and his men, as well as the Kerethites, the Pelethites, the mighty men. David is pushing all the forces he can muster to pursue Sheba. Now clearly Amasa caught up at some point, because when they got to Gibeon, Amasa arrived to take over the leadership again. That's what's being said in verse 8, that he went before them. So he's arrived again, he's taking over the leadership, he's ready to lead the army forward. When he meets with disaster, and disaster that goes by the name Joab. Under the pretense of friendship, Joab asked Amasa whether he was in health. He took him by the beard with the right hand, as if to kiss him. Now that might sound a bit strange to us. I certainly don't like the sound of someone taking me by the beard. But I presume this was a normal enough gesture, and I'm guessing it didn't involve too much hair pulling or anything like that. So he takes him by the beard. It's a token of friendship. He's going to greet him. It's the natural greeting of friends, showing love, showing care. But Amasa doesn't see the sword that Joab has in his left hand, the sword that Joab has let fall out of its sheath. And that sword soon found its home under Amasa's ribs. One swift blow, and it's done. Amasa is dead. This person who took Joab's job is very conveniently dispatched. Now Joab, in doing that, was forcefully reasserting his leadership over the army. And it was an open show of contempt. He left the body of Amasa just lying there in the highway with all of David's men marching past, and they're able to look on and see, here's what happens to the man who gets in Joab's way. And finally, after multitudes of Judah's soldiers had stopped to stare, someone had the idea to dump Amasa's body in a field and cover him with a cloth and put an end to the spectacle. I suppose it's easier to follow Joab and say that you're following David if you can't see the wicked thing that the man has just done. But here's yet another occasion when Joab is willing to resort to extreme wickedness simply for self-promotion, simply to get rid of a rival. It's not the first time he's done it. You might remember a way back when he did virtually the same thing to Abner. Abner was the man who had been general for Ishbosheth in the time of civil war. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, or the family of Saul, ruling in the north, David in the south, and Abner was his main man. But they had a falling out, and Abner came to make peace with David. And at that time, Joab saw Abner as a threat, probably, and just dispatched him, assassinated him. Now he does the same. He dispatches of yet another rival, Amasa, this time in the open highway. He was very publicly asserting, who cares what the king says? Who cares who the king gives this position to? It's mine. I'm taking it. And the sad thing is that it looks like Joab had the strength to do that. Because just like when he murdered Abner, he didn't face any consequences for this. In fact, the chapter 20 ends by telling you about Joab being over the host of Israel. He got his job back. He was so brazen, and David probably felt he couldn't risk opposing Joab, that Joab got his job. Didn't face the consequences, at least not yet. He will after David dies. David was going to order his execution by Solomon, but at this point he doesn't face any consequences. It seems David was too weak to deal with Joab properly. But the big point I want to get at here is that Joab was a man who in many ways was intensely loyal to David. You know, he risked his life many times to defend David, and although he often stooped to underhand tactics throughout his life, he generally always acted, at least in some sort of attempt, to protect and help David. Here's a man who remained within the kingdom of David, a man who claimed to love David, and in some sense of the word, I suppose he did. Whenever he killed Absalom, it was because he cared for David still being on the throne. He did not want someone else on the throne of Israel. He was loyal to David outwardly. He served David in David's army. He was continuing to do that in this chapter. And yet, just like Sheba, Joab was really a rebel against the rule of David. He might not leave the kingdom openly and rebel in that way and say, away, away with us. We're not going to follow David anymore. Follow me. He didn't do that. But while remaining inside the kingdom of David, he was not content to submit under the rule of David, at least not when it didn't suit him. David appoints someone else to be the commander-in-chief of the army. Joab's not having that. Yes, he's loyal to David in the main. Yes, he'll fight in David's cause, but he's not going to submit under that ruling. Through pride, through hating another person given his top position, through hating being humbled, he's willing to lift his hand and he strikes at Amasa. And as he strikes at Amasa, he's striking at David. He's jabbing his sword against David because he's undermining David's ruling. That's what's going on. Matthew Henry makes the comment, David was struck at through the side of Amasa and was in effect told to his face that Joab would be general in spite of him. Again, throughout his career, Joab was an intense loyalist for Israel and David, but it was always on his own terms. When it didn't suit him, when he didn't like David's command, who cares that David has given the commission to Amasa? I want it. I'll take it. Thank you very much. Now, Joab stands as a solemn reminder to us that rebellion can fester in our hearts and can be engaged in even from the inside. Even if we don't openly reject Christ, You know, today we might never imagine, you know, declaring to the world, I hate the Lord. I have got nothing to do with Jesus Christ. We might not dream of forsaking the church and or anything like that. And yet, it's still possible to rebel against the Lord, to have a rebellious heart, even if we're not openly, obviously rejecting Christ. In fact, perhaps Joab is the even more relevant warning to us than Sheba is, certainly in our setting here tonight, that there's plenty like Sheba in this world, plenty who will say, I want nothing to do with Christ, who will oppose him because they just refuse to submit themselves under his rule, full stop. For us, the danger is far more often that we would be a Joab. Openly, outwardly, we're submitting to Christ, we're even actively serving Christ in different ways, and yet always on our own terms. Because after all, we don't want to lose the preeminence. We don't want to lose our own say-so about how we'll use our lives, or what we'll do with it, or what our position will be. Pride stops us from stooping to yield ourselves fully to the command of Christ. We can be outwardly still serving him and active in his service, and yet still in various areas of life still refusing to truly acknowledge him as Lord and really retaining the lordship for ourselves. That there is such a thing as acknowledging the king's sovereignty, but at the same time disregarding his will. Now, all of this emphasises how important it is that we strive after humility, that we allow the Lord to cultivate humility in our proud hearts. Pride leads to division among God's people. It damages the work of God. It hinders our cause, as it did in David's day. And it also brings us to a position of rebellion. Sometimes outwardly, for many of us, even rebellion inwardly, while we remain within the kingdom of Christ. The great need of our hearts is that they would be continually humbled, that pride would be fought, and fought seriously and with urgency. And how do you do that? How do you overcome pride in your life? Again, here's perhaps the big thing to deal with before you even deal with the other surface sins in your life. How do you get to the root of the issue and fight pride? Well, the primary weapon that you have is the gospel itself. And as you continue to regularly look into the gospel and meditate upon the gospel of Christ, you have everything you need to overcome a spirit of pride in your heart. As you consider the gospel of Jesus Christ, you think about who you are without him and without the gracious work of God in your life. Where would you be without the grace of God? You'd be without hope. You'd be without anything to boast in. You'd be on your way to a lost eternity. As you consider the gospel of Christ, you're forced to recognize, you know, what do I have today that wasn't given to me? And the answer is nothing. I am what I am by the grace of God. And then as you look into the gospel and you behold the cross and the consequences of your sin borne by Christ, and then ask yourself, how much do I deserve the chief place? Do you not have to come to the answer? He must increase. I must decrease. There's my sin laid on him at the cross. There's what I deserve as I see him suffer and die and face the agony of God's rod upon his back. That's what I deserve. And look what I'm getting in exchange. I'm getting blessedness. I'm getting the joy of the Lord. But I deserve that. I deserved hell. I deserved the wrath of God. And look at the grace that's been shown me. The more we behold the gospel, the more we recognize that instead of deserving the chief place, our sin means we deserve the lowest place. In fact, we deserve hell. The more we behold the gospel and see the marvel of Christ's love to us, lifting us out of the dunghill and setting us among princes, the more we behold the cross where the justice and the mercy of God meet for our good, the more ready we'll be to come to what should be the obvious conclusion. He must increase. I must decrease. It's not about me, not about my glory, not about what I have to boast in. It's about the glory of the Saviour. That's what the gospel shows me, his greatness and my worthlessness without him. It's about the glory of the Saviour. And the gospel would cause us to say, yes, I will lay down my life in service for him. He will increase. I will decrease. I'll serve him. May God bless his word to us tonight. Amen.
Amen.